How do you see yourself in your main character, Pino Lella?
I see him as the skier. I'm a skier. I was able to relate to him right away because of that. His life was spent in the mountains. I spend my life in the mountains. We really were able to connect right on that basis, right off the bat. And because of that, and his level of expertise in skiing so jibed with my understanding that, you know, when he said that he was a great car driver, I didn't hesitate to believe him. But then I got in the car and was so scared that I've never been in a car with anybody driving like that. And this is when he was 78. So, you know, I'd like to think I'm a pretty adventurous guy, and I definitely see that part of myself in Pino Lella.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Mark Sullivan about his work of biographical and historical fiction and future feature-length film, Beneath a Scarlet Sky. You call this book a work of biographical and historical fiction, but Pino is a real person. So can you give us a brief sketch about his life?
Pino Lella is one of the more remarkable people I've ever met, probably in the top two or three. And he was 17 when the book starts. He is the scion of this very wealthy family in Milan. They were part of the fashion industry. They made purses and leather goods. And he was this kid right away who, you know, he was divorced from the war. It was all about what a 17-year-old kid's all about, you know, music and girls and food, and not necessarily in that order. And yet the war comes for him. His house gets bombed and he gets sent to this boys' school up in the Alps, Casalpino, where there's a very courageous priest, Father Ray. So he gets up there, and of course, the Nazis being the Nazis, they start hunting for the Jews. And in Italy, they formed a Catholic underground to get Jews out of Nazi-occupied Italy or to hide them. And one of the routes went through this Catholic boys' school, Casalpino, which was high in the Alps, but not all the way up. It sits on a plateau called the Moda Plateau. And from there were three main routes that they took him on. And he becomes, in the spring of 1944, after leading all these escapes out of Casalpino, he's about to turn 18, and his parents are petrified that he's going to be conscripted. And at that time, if you were taken into the Italian army, or the Army of Salò, as it was called by that point, you were usually sent to the Russian front, or you were sent to Russian front or Eastern front, however you want to call it at that point, or you were sent to work in a factory in Germany where you were also liable to be bombed. So they came up with this audacious plan to get him into a little known part of the Nazi war machine, which was called the Organization Tote. It was a quasi-military operation. They would take control of factories to build them and to build parts for their trucks and tanks, etc. And through a series of remarkable circumstances, in the summer of 1944, Pino becomes a driver for the head of the Organization Tote, actually what was called a plenipotentiary, which means he had the full authority of a Reich minister, in this case, Albert Speer, who was Hitler's architect. And Pino becomes his driver, and General Layers, Major General Hans Layers, he's the one who's responsible for building the fortifications, the supplies, the cement, everything is there. And so Pino goes with him, and he ends up seeing everything the general sees and where he goes and what he does. And he starts reporting it back to his uncle, who was a member of the resistance and in control of a shortwave radio. At the same time, he falls in love with the maid of the general's mistress, Dolly. And the maid's name, Anna Marta. And she's 6 years older than him. And she's a widow. And she's from Trieste. And because he is basically being this spy in total secrecy, a lot of his family members don't even know, and they've disowned him because they think he's become a Nazi. He's wearing the swastika. At that point, he he has to find refuge somewhere from all the horrible stuff he sees, and they fall in love.
So in thinking about where the book begins, you refer to Pino as a forgotten hero, and the book reads like a hero's journey.
Yes.
So I'm thinking about what Pino's call to adventure was.
I think it was largely a function of location. As a child, he was sent to Father Ray's boys' camp, which is what it was before the war. It was a place for them to go and spend a month learning how to ski, and then another month to 2 months in the summer climbing and hiking and doing all these things that he wouldn't have done in Milan. And once he was exposed to that, that's where his great love of life was in the Alps and in the mountains. He never lost that. Continues to just thrive when he talks about, he lights up when he talks about mountains and skiing and alpine. So that's where it came from. It was simply that they put him there and he fell in love with it.
Will you read a piece from Casa Alpina?
I will. That'd be great. So this piece begins when Pino has already been shown or reminded of and trained in the mountains and gotten the different routes squared away so that he can do them. And we're now in, I believe, late October of 1943. And he's told to come to the chapel outside Casa Alpina. Pino saw the trials of the past few weeks in a different light, and he felt excited and filled with new purpose. "You want me to guide them, Father?" Pino asked. "The three Jews. Three of God's children whom he loves," Father Ray said. "Will you help them?" "Of course, yes." The priest put his hand on Pino's shoulder. "I want you to understand that you will be risking your life. Under the new German rules, helping a Jew is an act of treason and punishable by death. If you are caught, they will likely execute you." Pino swallowed hard at that, felt shaken inside, but then looked at Father Ray and said, "Aren't you risking your life just having them here at Casa Alpina?" "And the boy's life," the priest said, his face sober. "But we must help all refugees fleeing the Germans. The Pope thinks so. Cardinal Schuster thinks so. And so do I." "I do too, Father," Pino said, emotional in a way he had never been before, as if he were about to go out and right a great wrong. "Good," Father Ray said, his eyes glistening. "I had faith you would want to help." "I do," Pino said, and felt stronger for it. "I'd better go to sleep." "I'll get you up at 2:15. Father Bormio will feed you all at 2:30. You'll leave at 3. Pino left the chapel believing that he'd entered it as a boy and now exited having made the decision to become a man. He was frightened by the penalty for helping the Jews, but he was going to help them anyway. He stood out in front of Casa Alpina before going in, staring to the northeast, across the flank of the Gropera, and understanding that three lives were now his responsibility. That young couple, the smoker, they depended on him for this last stage of their escape. Pino looked up past the massive crag of the Gropera, silhouetted in the moonlight to the stars and the black void beyond. "Dear God," he whispered, "help me."
It seems Pino's initiated or crosses a threshold at Casa Alpina. What were the elements, you think, that led him to become or feel like he's become a man?
I think he basically took people over the mountain. He took responsibility for people's lives other than his own. He became altruistic and through it became a man.
As well as Father Ray, who are his other mentors and helpers along the way?
Well, certainly Alberto Ascari, who teaches him to drive. In reality, it didn't happen exactly that way, but I had to get Alberto Ascari in there. Otherwise, you wouldn't have believed that Pino Lella could drive like he drives. You had to understand that he was trained by one of the greatest drivers in the world. And I can attest to, having been in a car with him multiple times before he stopped driving, that he drove like a race car driver.
I mean, at age 89?
Not at 89, okay. But at 78, he sure as hell did. You know, it was unreal. He rode a motorcycle until he was like 88, 89.
And a hero doesn't become a hero without challenges and risks. Can you just give us a sketch of some of the challenges Pino faced?
Well, certainly in the mountains, if he had been caught, he would have been shot. There was no doubt about it. That's what they did. They were trying to institute a reign of fear and terror in the country. And so there was a constant feeling that they could get caught out there, that they could come over the top of the Gropera and there'd be, you know, Germans waiting for them. So anyway, when he becomes a member of the organization Tote, he gets into situations where he's spying on General Layers, and if he's caught, he's put against a wall and shot. So literally from late September of 1943 through the very end of the war, he's in danger of being put against a wall and shot every day of his life.
And maybe to ease his mind, there presents this lovely opportunity in Anna, who he actually met earlier when he was just a boy.
Yes.
One of the things that you write as her, saying, "I'm not ready to reveal my scars to you. I don't want you to see me human and flawed and whole. I want this, us, to be a fantasy we can share, a diversion from the war." How did you know that you wanted to write it that way?
Hearing the story, especially the story of him and Anna, was the most emotional thing I have ever gone through as a writer. You know, and just about every aspect of his journey during that last 20 months of the war was deeply emotional. And it, as I said before, it changed me in a way that I never expected. And I knew that what he had done was opened up his scarred heart. And I wanted to have that as a theme early, because I believe that is when we're made whole in the eyes of other people, when we can show them our flaws and our scars and the good things and the bad things that have happened to us. And that's when we see the true nature of a relationship too, is through that.
Which brings me to your own journey then with this book.
Right.
If you can, talk about maybe your sense of the dark forest or
sure.
the abyss.
Sure.
Maybe in contrast or comparison to Pino's.
Well, for those of you who've not read the book, the way I found the story was fairly remarkable. It is to me. It was in February of 2006. My younger brother and best friend had drunk himself to death. I'd written a novel that no one liked. I was in this huge, long business dispute that had us on the verge of personal bankruptcy. And driving on a snowy Montana afternoon to Costco, of all places, in Bozeman, I realized that I was worth more dead than alive. And I seriously considered driving into the 19th Street Bridge abutment. No one would have suspected suicide. My family could have collected on the insurance. But I didn't. I saw my wife and kids in the snow, and I didn't. But I pulled into the Costco parking lot as rattled as I've been in my entire life. And I put my head down, and I begged God and the universe for a story. Something that had purpose and meaning, because I wasn't feeling the purpose and meaning in my life at that point. And I went home, didn't tell my wife what I'd gone through. She was sick with the flu. And that evening, she forces me to go to a dinner party that I had no interest in attending. I go to the dinner party because the reason she forces me to is we had turned them down three times. And I needed to go, so I go, and I'm miserable, but I'm trying to put on a happy face. And during the course of the dinner, a person who was at the dinner starts telling me about Pino Lella. And I can't believe it at first. I didn't believe it at first. I just said, you know, we would have heard this story, this, mm-hmm. you know, bringing Jews over the top of the Alps into Switzerland, skiing them on their backs and spying inside the German high command. And then the next thing I heard was, he's alive. You know, and I said, he's alive. How's that possible? Well, he's like 78. He was only 17 during the war. Mm. So 61 years had gone by. And I found Robert Dahlendorf, who was a Montanan and had owned the ranch where The Horse Whisperer was filmed. And he had heard the story by chance. Again, serendipity. If Robert Dahlendorf hadn't been walking down a street in northern Italy and seen Pino Lella's sports car and stopped to admire it, he never would have become a friend with Pino, and the story would have been lost.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Mark Sullivan about his book, Beneath a Scarlet Sky. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What do you think what were Pino's anchors through the darkest times of the war?
Well, I think love. You know, his love for her, his love for his family, his love for his country. It was the thing that supported him. And he genuinely likes people. He's one of these instantaneous friends kind of guy. And very warm, very loving, very giving. Not a perfect man by any stretch of the imagination, but then again, who is? Everybody has their scars. And I learned that from him. I learned that if somebody could go through what he had gone through, my own personal problems, my situation as I listened to him became paler and paler and smaller and smaller, and I recognized that I had a pretty sweet life and I should be grateful for it. And I left Italy vowing to tell his story to as many people as possible.
It sounds like then that's your return and your revelation is some perspective.
Yes.
Other than love, or maybe along with love, how does Pino re-enter his life with what kind of new sense, I guess, of the world? You know, what is his revelation?
His revelation is that every day is a miracle, even if it's the worst day you can imagine. It's still miraculous. And if you can wake up every morning beginning with that perspective, that it is a miracle, that there's no reason we should be here, you know, that there is a genuine reason, but it's beyond us. And it has to do with going on and helping your fellow man and finding meaning and purpose in your life. And the story gave me meaning and purpose and changed it.
There's also a theme of being unseen and existing in the shadows.
Yes.
What does it mean for Pino to be unseen?
Well, in the story, it's that his own brother, who he loves, thinks he's a traitor. His best friend thinks he's a traitor for wearing the swastika. And this is a very difficult thing for him to handle because he mattered in the Alps, right? He was somebody who did the right thing and he mattered, and he gets to Milan, and at first he doesn't matter, and then he becomes the general's driver, and of course he matters a great deal, but he can't tell anyone, and no one knows, for a while, and then Anna knows. But he has to suffer in effect in order to be effective, and they did it for his own good. You know, his uncle said, listen, the more people who know, the more likely you're going to be caught and shot, and we can't do it, so you have to basically play a role. And he did. And it was difficult for him. Brutal for him. Can you imagine being 18 and your best friend thinks you're a traitor and your own brother thinks you're a traitor? That's pretty heavy stuff to handle.
Yeah.
And he does handle it in the best way that he can. And he goes on. And there's another instance of, again, life can be pretty rough. But if you go on and you keep putting one foot in front of the other and believing in the fact that the very next moment in your life, something miraculous can happen, then your life begins to change.
Mm. Yeah. What do you think it does to a person to lead a double life?
Oh, I think it's very tough. You're forced to constantly be thinking, how do I justify to one person? And I can't use that to justify something to another person. It's a split that I think has got to be terribly difficult. I can't imagine being a spy, really. I mean, I've gotten inside his head, but to constantly be aware that you could be caught, I mean, it just has to chew at you. It just has to keep you up at night and make you nervous and upset and easily, anxiety-ridden. He manages to hold on and do it in a remarkable way, which is what I admired about him, you know, right from the get-go.
In thinking about the elements of craft in writing this book and being a spy, you use several different foreign languages. Yes. How did you know where to insert Italian, where to put in German, where to put in English, where to put in French?
Yeah, it was almost impossible. It was trial and error to try to get it right so that, I mean, what I was after constantly with this book is write it in a way to reach the most people. Mm-hmm. I tried to do that. I think I succeeded. I've gotten all sorts of letters from people everywhere from 12 to 88 who've read it and were able to access it. There was no barrier to the story. Anybody could understand the story. So I kept the Italian to a minimum. I kept the German to a minimum. You know, I kept the French to a minimum. They were in there because they had to be there. And I think, you know, we have to remember that this did take place in Italy. But there were early drafts where there was a lot more Italian and, a lot more German. And I kept saying to myself, I am losing readers right here. And so I changed. Yeah. So,
one of the obstacles that you write that you encountered in the process of this book was the collective amnesia of Italians after the war. Can you describe that in further detail?
Sure. Yeah, I was hampered in a lot of ways. I don't speak Italian. I don't speak German. I don't read either language. I didn't understand anything about the organization TOTE when I started. For those of you who don't understand that, OT built anything that the German war effort needed, and they did it through slavery. I mean, they used a euphemistic term, forced labor, but they were slaves. And that was one of the things that I struggled to understand was the scope of it. And to understand how it functioned in Italy. So that was a huge barrier. There was a barrier at the beginning because Pino had so blocked everything about the story that at first he didn't remember Layer's name. He always called him Mon Generale. Mm-hmm. So I spent a bunch of time churning until I finally keyed in on General Layers, who, because of his role as a plenipotentiary, had almost like a superpower over the organization TOTE. So it took me a long time, and I admit to being slow on the uptake about that, to really get in straight in my mind how the organization functioned and who had the real power. That said, there were so many documents who were burned and so many people had died by the time I got to the story that I got to a point about 5 years ago where I recognized that my goal of telling the story as a straight nonfiction book was not going to happen. Uh-huh. It was beyond my abilities. And, you know, I had to basically resign myself to that. A very smart person that I know in publishing said to me, you know, if you really think about this, this story was given to you long after you left being a journalist and you became a novelist. The story came to you for a reason. You're a novelist. Write it as a novel. Mm. And once I did that, it was very freeing because I was allowed to write it based on fact and suspicion, very well-informed suspicion, but suspicion. And at that point, it's fiction, and there was no two ways about it. And I struggled with that a little bit, but then I finally gave into it, and I gave into the heart of the story versus the intellectual part of the story. And I recognized that as a novelist, my role really, if I was to do this right, was to give the reader the same emotional experience that Pino went through, that I went through 60 years later, and that, you know, I hope that all readers who read it would go through.
What sustained you through those years of rabbit trails and trying to determine how to write the book?
Him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your relationship like with him now?
Oh, I love the guy. His story rescued me from a very dark place. He showed me a new way to think about life. He showed me what it was to be someone who lived a long life in which you are going to endure tragedy. It happens. And it's how you deal with it. It's the meaning you give it. And, you know, his tragedy becomes something completely different. It's a story of great beauty, you know? So.
Transformation. Maybe.
Transformation. That's what it is. And yeah, he's just a good friend, too. You know, he's a much older man. And so I'm like the kid with him, and I can learn from him, and I have learned from him.
And he's, you know, he's remarkable that way. One of the best moments of my life was bringing the book to him back in June, and was remarkable. It was, you know, felt like it'd come full circle.
Yeah, what was his reaction when you handed it to him?
He couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's emotional.
It is. You know, this was a dream that he and I had, and Robert Dahlendorf, who's, you know, also almost 90, and have it actually happen was remarkable. And he's been read all the reviews on Amazon. We have like more than 6,500 five-star reviews, and he just can't believe it, you know, and he wants to hug everybody who's, you know, written and loves it. And he's genuinely baffled by how powerful his story was.
That you've helped him become seen.
Yes. And, you know, he said to me in a very private moment with us, he said, "You justified my life."
Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any greater honor than that, maybe.
True.
Did you get a chance to go skiing with him?
Oh, that is one of the great, great lacks in this story, if you will. He had decided to quit skiing by the time he was 77. He was having a lot of knee problems at that time. He probably could have gone back and skied, but he gave it up a year or two before I met him, and he just wasn't up to it. But everybody I know who had seen him ski just said it was like watching a dream. You know, it was just so fluid. He was so part of the mountain that it was remarkable. So yeah, that's one of my great regrets, is I never got to ski with Pino Lella.
Yeah. If you could imagine a Pino of the 21st century refugee crisis, what do you imagine his or her role would be?
Well, first of all, do I think that there are people like Pino right now? In the world, absolutely. And they always rise in the worst places.
Mm-hmm.
They always rise under the worst circumstances. And they're usually very ordinary people who suddenly become larger than themselves. And it happens one way. It happens because they give of themselves with no thought of themselves. And there are heroes, I'm sure, in Syria right now that are taking care of the wounded, that are getting wounded people out of places, that are helping to smuggle people out of the country. Imagine there are people in sub-Saharan Africa going, and even in Agadez, where I used to live, who are rising to the occasion and acting beyond themselves. I truly believe that. And so doctors, aid workers, locals who basically stand up to tyrants, they're out there. I know those stories are there right now.
Prior to living in Bozeman, Montana, where he's an avid skier and adventurer, Mark Sullivan lived in Niger, West Africa, as a Peace Corps volunteer. Look for more information about him and Beneath a Scarlet Sky at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.